do we call them the Beatitudes? And I thought, that's a very obvious question. I haven't got a clue. So I asked, and someone had their iPad, and I'm very grateful to Susan, who's my research assistant. And I realized, of course, that Magnificat is because Magnificat is the first Latin word in the Vulgate for when Mary magnifies the Lord. And Beati, Beatus, is the first word in the Latin Vulgate meaning blessed. So that's why they're called Beatitudes. But the people who also suggested that I said with a great authority, it's a be attitude. These are attitudes to be. I also thought that was a good answer.
Great. Judging, in light of each of us being imperfect, what qualifies elders to judge others? And how should they carry out those judgments in light of God's loving grace? The question, elders judging, why should you as a parent be able to judge? Why should the government be able to judge? It's not because of perfection. It's because of the position that they've been put in. And so we respond to the elders of the church because they have spiritual authority. They have to be qualified. And I think one of the difficulties is if we allow unqualified people to get into positions, then we've got a real dilemma because we are trying to respond both to the position but to them as people. There should be a consistency there. Why do your kids obey you? Because mom said so. But that will only come through with good authority if mom is also not being hypocritical and is actually doing that. So why do we obey elders? Because they're going to have to answer to God for how they led the church, their spiritual oversight. And Paul says that. You're going to be answering to God. There's going to be a crown for elders. So we respond to them because of their position backed by their lifestyle. Peter.
I like this. We get microphones right here. We don't have to do anything. All right. Hey, my question is this. Any suggestions on sibling rivalry? I mean, like now when I'm as old as I am? Or we have two that don't get along, and it changes our family dynamics. All right, like my answer would come in reference to what we talked about last night with taste worship and the whole experience that we did last night. When it comes to sibling rivalries and so forth, what we've done in our family and what we've done with our ministry with Taste Worship is we try to, it depends on how severe the rivalry is, but our goal is this, as much as you can get them to touch and to do things together and to be a part of something where they have to figure something out, instead of making it a discipline, go to your rooms or, you know, go outside until one is knocked down, lying on the ground, and then come back inside. We've done things where we've said, all right, so here's the deal. You have to come up with a dinner plan, and you have to feed the whole family. So if you two can't figure it out, the rest of us will be looking at you saying, why don't we get to eat? So you go to the kitchen, and I mean, we do this when they're 10 and 11 years old, and you say, you two are in charge of dinner. Well, I'll come back, and you figure it out. And the whole idea is to get them working and get them distracted from whatever make them going apart. One thing my wife did one day when it came to this, she actually, the boys were getting all nasty with each other. So she said, fine. So she went and got a dish towel, and she tied their elbows together. Or actually, it was at their wrists. And said, so for the rest of the afternoon, you will hang out together. And they had to eat dinner like that. And they couldn't feed themselves. They had to feed each other. Needless to say, that issue was resolved after dinner. And it also makes it fun. It makes it a little creative and takes the edge off of just, you know, always having to be policemen in your house. But for us, we always think of ways, how can you get them to serve, to do something productive with each other, to do something outside of themselves, and to touch, or to do something like that. That seems to somehow change the dynamic a little bit. It's a process. There's no instant fix.
Just on that exact same thing, there's a need not being met, or there's a comparison that is being made, and it's important for the parents to try to understand what's behind the rivalry. sometimes you have a younger brother that's excelling at sports and the older brother's falling behind, and you know, he feels he's losing out, and so often it's a lack of significance in the family, a threat feeling, and so be wise as parents to try to understand what's behind it so you can address it at the core level. You have to decide whether this is a deep-seated core growing issue or whether it's more of a surface just fighting each other issue, which all the things that were said would be great advice for that. So you have to discern at what level the issues are, okay? What characteristics for an accountability partner? And it asks here about women, how do you talk about issues and not gossip or be disrespectful? First of all, characteristics are available, committed to what you want to do, i.e. grow in the Lord, grow in your walk as a woman or as a man. And so availability, I think it's really important. I always talk about with the men that you have to have somebody who has teeth, who's going to clearly be willing to call me to account. At the same time, I love to say that my accountability partner is one who is I can brag to and I can bellyache to, and they accept me just the same. They can give me perspective when I'm over the top on my bragging or excitement about things. And they can also encourage me when I'm overreacting in a negative sense and pull me along in a healthy way. As far as the gossip line within it, if I'm dealing with my own issues, rarely is there gossip. So if my accountability partner and I are working through our issues, it's not a lot of gossip. The other thing, too, is because this is a holy huddle, he and I, in this case, of course, my accountability partner, Larry, we talk about a lot of things, but it's in the covenant of this privacy here. And both of our wives know we talk about our marriage. Okay? And there's times that I say to Larry, I'd appreciate if this one doesn't go to Marlene, and he says sometimes the same to me about Donna Lynn. But Donna Lynn knows that Larry and I talk about our marriage virtually every week because we go in, and one of the things we want to do is become a godly man and a godly husband, godly father. And so where I have dropped the ball with Donna Lynn, I volunteer, and he says, okay, well, what do you need to do? And I think I'd like you to talk this. The next week, first thing he says, so what did you do last week to resolve that? So we don't spend a lot of time, if I can use the word, trashing our spouses because we're looking to try to build a way to work it through. We do talk about the stuff. But that's not gossip. It's trying to resolve problems. But we don't talk about people outside, so that would be the easiest way to handle that.
Just to follow up an obvious thing, too. Those of us who work in churches with others and have teams, some of us may be, obviously, in ministry leadership, but they're different teams, including, of course, working with young people and with children, with each other. What I have always said when I've been preparing people is to seek when you begin, say you're moving into a situation as a new leader, seek to whether you can develop a covenant together about how you will respect each other, but ensure that others do not inveigle you in the mischief making of setting you against other team members and preferring you to others. And it's a very important task to say, listen, especially in some areas of ministry where there can be jealousy and rivalry and tension, to keep a sense of accountability and covenant. We used to say this, and whenever we met Mondays after we'd been together as a team, one of the key things was to be straight with each other and to speak the truth to each other. But it was with a kind of working relationship as well. So it wasn't just personal, sometimes that was it, but you know, sort of thing. That's obvious thing, I'm sure. But covenant, I think, especially to say, I will not let anybody speak about somebody else disrespectfully. You know, we work together, we love the Lord together, etc. The pure in heart will see God, Matthew 5:8. That sort of rings a bell. I think we've been there recently. What does it mean to see God in this verse? And what did it mean to your father who devoted so many years to prayer? Can I say, of course, seeing literally, there's a tension in scripture, you better not see God. That's the last thing you'll do. And so Moses wants to see and the glory passes by. And we have this contrast in John 1. In verse 18, where it says, no one has seen the Father, the one and only. But in verse 14, we behold his glory in Jesus. So the first witnesses actually see God the Father. But he's expressed, that's what the incarnation means. They see him. and we build on their witness. Without their witness, we're doomed. I mean, the resurrection depends upon witnesses who saw this. And when you look at it, it's extraordinarily convincing. Actually, I needed convincing because it's when I was 16, 17, I went through a great time of doubt. And as I began to look at the evidence through the help of who moved the stone, Frank Morrison, was it?
At that stage, I think so.
That was kind of Lee Strobel and others today.
Yes.
I was helped to see. These eyewitnesses saw something. And Jesus, another beatitude, blessed to those who haven't seen but believe. But there is, what's the song? Open the eyes of my heart, Lord. Open the eyes of my heart. We've sung it twice. Of course, Jesus is talking metaphorically often. He says the Pharisees are blind. It's in front of their noses, they don't see it. And the truth is, when it comes to spiritual perception, it's a profound issue of being pure in heart, which is all tied up with admitting who you are and your need of God. If you don't come poor in spirit, and you don't come with the spirit of meekness and mercy, and they come together, then you will just see around you, sadly, what everybody else sees. And actually, if you're in a real mess, and you're messed up with pornography or something, it will affect everything. But if you come because you are seeking, I admit, I'm not in a good place now. And I admit, I've not been very merciful there, and I know I need your mercy because it needs to. The things we've been talking about. Then open the eyes of my heart. The headquarters of my personality becomes reality. And this is the power. Yes, we have seen God the Father in Jesus. Unbelievable, world-changing. Yes, we can behold his glory through the witnesses and the testimony of the Spirit. And yes, right now, when our hearts are open, the headquarters of our personalities, then there can be a seeing. And a loving, a perception of discernment. And I had just to say about my dad, the thing about my father was that he was a very contemplative individual and gave me a really rough time in ministry. Because as an activist, not as activist, Carol, so there was always a relative, and it's very relative, but he was always saying, the margin. My mother came to stay my first year. I'm taking more. You said 90 seconds. Anyway, hold on. I won't talk so much next time. When my mother came, well, I probably will. But anyway, my mother came to stay, and I wanted her to really admire me in my first church in Blackburn. And I preached my heart out on the Sunday. She was there, and I was off and doing this, that, and the other. And midway through the week, she said, Michael, you don't seem to spend much time with the Lord on your own. Because she knew, I mean, the kids were awake at 6:30 or whatever, and I was there, and she was absolutely right. So I've learned a lot from my parents, and I think it does come back to this. I saw them modeling at a very high level, my father. I've always felt guilty, still do. I still do, because he was exceptional. That's the scene.
When Greg and I meet, this is back two questions, then I'll go to his, then I'll go to mine. In 40 seconds or less. When Greg and I meet together about gossip, our question we ask each other is, are we part of the solution, a part of the problem, or part of the solution in this case? If we're not part of the problem, we shouldn't be talking about it unless we're part of the solution. If we're not part of the problem, we're not part of the solution, then we don't talk about what's happening in these other two people's lives. I think that's a little helpful thing. In the New Testament, notice the blind men always see. Always see. Blind people see. That's a very interesting thing. So they're listening to truth. My question to the guy with the beard, who it's addressed to. He's trying. With your son's struggle with alcohol, how would you advise Christians teach their children about its dangers and proper use? We don't drink, and had a grandfather who's an alcoholic. How can we protect our children? great question. It doesn't deal just with alcohol. I mean, it deals with drugs and anything that people can become addicted to. And because of sin, we all are addicted to sin. Christ can come in and can change our lives, but if we allow the old nature to come out, it's there. And so not only with alcohol, drugs, but with other things, I think we need to speak to our children early. I wish I had spoken to my son earlier about alcohol. I told him not to drink, that he wasn't of age, it was illegal and things like that. But I wish I had actually spoken to him about Sharon's natural father, who was an alcoholic, who my grandfather was an alcoholic, that there was a danger there so that he would have been aware. The other thing is I made rules about drinking and smoking and everything, and I did not leave room for the opportunity that if they did fall, that they could come and see me. They knew that I was going to be so disappointed that they would never have admitted it. I said to my son, why didn't you come and talk to me when you realized you couldn't stop? And he just kind of looked at me with big eyes and said, well, I just knew that you would be so disappointed. And so I think that one thing we need to do is understand that most of our children are going to get into trouble in one area of their life or the other. Do you just want to condemn them, or do you want to be there to help them when they do get into that? I've blown it many, many times in various areas of my life, and we can become very proud because I do not have an addiction to alcohol. I have no desire. I've never gotten drunk in my life. Took beer once, one sip, grade 4. My mother told me I could. She told me drink lots of it, spit it out on the floor. I was also a smoker in kindergarten. Neighbor over said to my mother, can I smoke? She said, take lots of it. I just about died on the floor. My brother did, and he liked it. So it doesn't always work when you tell your kids to go ahead and do it. Our kids need to understand the dangers of all sorts of addictions that are out there. You as parents need to become aware of what's out there. There is a proper use for some of this, and to go all one way and say, my kids will never ever drink or touch alcohol, they probably will. What happens? Can they come and talk to you about it? And I wish I had opened the door wide to say, now, I don't want you to drink, but when you drink and you need to talk to me about it, you can just come, we can talk, and it's safe. The guy with the small beard, do you have a question?
This is the best I can do. I'm trying. just open anybody at the table here who has kids. How do you handle or restrict multimedia, parentheses, iPhones, with teenagers without shutting them out of their world, parentheses, with their friends?
I'll put it away.
We need to learn, don't we? Here's the thing. This thing is like anything else. It can be really good, but as Scripture has said, good things can be used and turned into bad if not used rightly. A computer's great, but easier access to porn is not. You know, food can be great, but comfort food to the point of where it's killing your body and obesity or whatever else, you get the point. And everything needs guidelines and everything needs restrictions. What we've done and things that we've done with our family. In fact, let me just do this. I'm going to, on the table, I have these things and their ideas. And actually, I think Dean was being willing to pass them out. We send out ideas that we do with Taste Worship. The whole Taste Worship is drawing families closer to God and closer together. And we send out monthly ideas on how to help your family using elements of worship to draw it closer together. It will get to this. I'll explain why. And so if you would like that, we'll actually even do some giveaways if you want. If you want to fill that out and just put it back at the table. One of the ideas that we have done when it comes to iPhones, because I have a 14-year-old, almost 15, who has his own phone. He pays for it himself with jobs that he does. And my other kids have iTouches that they bought with their own birthday money that they saved for a couple years and different things. They're good because I can text my kids and I can just say, how you doing? I can send them a picture. Hey, here I am, you know, doing this or doing that. Here I am trying to grow my beard, whatever I am trying to do. But the thing is this, folks, is that one of the ideas we talk about in our family and with Taste Worship, an idea that we got from a family out in Arizona, they do a media fast. And mom and dads have to do it too. No TV, or however you decide, you had no phones, no texting, no movies, no nothing for a whole week. And just put them down. And you let them experience going, this is what life can be like without them. How, then when you get to the end of the week, how did it feel? How did it go? When it comes to those types of things, or we actually use them for this. We actually set our alarms on our family, like when I'm gone, set the alarm to go off at 1 o'clock. So now we take advantage of the iPhone, and we say, when it goes off at 1 o'clock, everybody set your alarms. When your alarm goes off, pray for each other. Pray for your sister, pray for your brother, pray for mom or dad. And everybody's praying for each other at the same time. Again, we're trying to draw the families closer to God and closer together. Here's boundaries that we set with our phones, if this is helpful to the, whoever asked this question. We don't allow any phone, we don't allow any texting or anything during in the car, especially when you're driving. And you're 11-year-olds, you shouldn't be driving. But we don't, and when we have music or like that types of stuff, it's all open. Meaning we just take turns listening in the car. We don't use headphones in the car. In the phones, we don't, if there is texting or anything, the kids know that we get to see every text right now because we're like, well, if you can't have the conversation out loud with your friends, with mom and dad around, then we want to talk about that and why that's important. And we are also very much about never in church, not in the car on the way to church. If you really need to text, talk to us about what it is, if it's the information that needs to be transferred or whatever it is. But we just set boundaries, but we also give a blessing to when they do text. Yeah, go ahead, text your friend. That's totally fun. But you make a blessing on one side, and then you also say, but here's the boundaries. And have your kids set up the boundaries. What would be okay, what wouldn't be okay? Involve them in that decision. They'll actually come farther. They'll have harder boundaries sometimes than you would. It's pretty good. So this can be good things, and they can be not, just like anything. Just work it out with them. Talk it over with them.
10 seconds on the drinking comment. You need to normalize the fact that your kids will be facing a battle and making decisions. You got to normalize that. That means you talk about it early, except as you grow up, you're going to know at 14, 15, you'll be at someone's house, and they're going to say, hey, do you want a drink? You're going to have to make decisions. Let me tell you why your mom and I have made the decisions we have. And sometimes it's who you're getting the drink from is critical. Sometimes where you're drinking is critical. I counsel people who have been date raped or raped because of the date rape drug. And they were 14 or 15. Up where we live right now, they have inviting, it's like there's actually an acrostic, and I forgot it, I'm embarrassed. But around where we live, they have 19 to 23-year-old boys inviting 13, 14 girls to their parties. And they give them the date rape drug, and they go home having been laid 6, 8, 10 times by different guys. That's in where I live, in a very conservative region. And that's all around drinking. So you got to talk very open. Yes?
LG.
Yeah, little girl parties, LG parties. And so what you got to understand is there's a lot of things going with drinking today. Okay, so normalize the fact that they are going to face it and coach them why you don't, what they do when it comes up, how to say no. Then you still have to make decisions about, you know, when it's okay to drink. That's your call as a family. On this texting thing and phoning thing, you got to warn the kids sincerely about sexting. Were you talking sexual messages through sexting or texting? Understand that if it's a minor who is passing a lurid picture around on his phone of a girlfriend he took when she was half naked, that is child pornography in our province. We are not as strict in some areas as you guys, but in our province, we have people going to juvenile court at 16 because they sent a half-naked picture of a girlfriend in the internet. Do you understand that? So you've got to talk openly. I'm writing articles on this right now on my website and coaching people, but the whole thing. By the way, phones can have curfews. They all go off at 9 o'clock, right? You know what I'm saying? Curfews on phones, curfews on cars, et cetera, et cetera. I got a question here about disciplining children and sparing the rod and all that thing. With regard to discipline, corporal punishment and all that, we spanked all of our kids. But got to understand that in the context, you say the word spank in our culture and you're a beating parent. You understand that? I correct my kid to get their attention. You see what I'm saying? I correct my kid whenever I need to get their attention. Sometimes it takes a little swat in the behind. Now, you say swat in the behind, that's really different than I spank my kid, because they have this aversion to spank your kid. I believe this is saying, correct your kid to the point of getting his or her attention. All right? But the whole spanking world, it's got to be getting better responses by different things already by 6, 7, and 8. You know what I'm saying? You don't need to be spanking kids that are getting that age and beyond. Okay, there's different ways because they already found out what's important to them. We correct them by getting their attention when they're younger, when you're trying to build a trust in you that you really are authority, you call the shots, and there's no one else who calls the shots but me. Why? Because there's going to be a time that they're going to run across the street and you're going to say, "You stop right now!" And if they have not learned to listen to you, they're dead. And you discipline because you love these kids. That's what Scripture's saying. And, you know, spare the rod. Now, they may be disciplined a little different than us, but the point being, there is a point that I will correct by getting their attention. And it's never the type that's leaving bruises. It's never to the face, right? You know what I'm saying? And my kids always used to love it when Donalyn would spank them, because they would talk afterwards how it didn't, they would just pretend to be crying, right? Or they'd pull on a second pair of pants and wouldn't even feel nothing. They'd laugh after. You know what? But there's games that go on, right? And we had a spanking spoon, you know. I broke a couple, you know. So, okay, good enough.